The frontier is best led with a sense of co-creation, not just with the robots that are already here, but with teams that can know what to do with that together, and you build that together.
Before we get to today's interview, I thought I would quickly address the elephant in the room. There are a ton of talented people still out of work and not enough jobs to go around. I feel you. Standing out from the competition probably feels impossible in this market. That's why I created my all-new Branding Makeover Masterclass that I'm going to be launching for the first time live via Zoom on Saturday, February 8th. Whether you're navigating a major career pivot, pursuing your next dream job, or simply just trying to land the next gig, this masterclass will equip you with both the mindsets and the strategies to rewrite the story of your personal brand so you can then apply that story to update your resume, your portfolio, LinkedIn, and other social profiles, and most importantly, wow them in the room for your next interview. Regardless of all of our current challenges, I am confident that your lifetime of skills, knowledge, and experience are far more valuable to the right people than you know. And I want to help you identify what makes you unique so you can stand out, get noticed, and continue building the creative career that you deserve. To add your name to the waitlist so you're the first to hear when registration goes live, visit optimizeyourself.me/branding. Again, that is optimizeyourself.me/branding. And now on to today's show. My name is Zach Arnold, and I'm a former Hollywood film and television editor turned career strategist and the creator of Optimize Yourself, where I help artists, creatives, and storytellers just like you design the more balanced, more sustainable, and more fulfilling creative career that you deserve. In a nutshell, I'm Tim Ferriss meets Ted Lasso, minus the mustache, because I am obsessed with both learning everything I can about optimizing human potential while also inspiring you to realize yours. If you are ready to step outside your comfort zone, let's dive right in and unlock the optimized version of you. Hello, and welcome to the Optimize Yourself podcast, where I share honest and candid conversations with best-selling authors, world-class athletes, Hollywood legends, elite experts in a variety of fields, as well as everyday people that are achieving extraordinary things. It means the world to me that with all the podcast choices out there, you have chosen to invest your valuable time, energy, and attention with me. Now, before we get started, don't forget to visit optimizeyourself.me/podcast so you can subscribe, leave a review, and so you can also download your unique customized podcast playlist where I'm going to send you the 5 best expert interviews from our archives to help you achieve your specific goals. So on that note, without further ado, let's get right to today's guest. I'm here today with Chris Deaver, who's the co-founder of BraveCore, which is a leadership consultancy that helps leaders be more creative, but also helps creatives be better leaders. You have influenced Fortune 500s from the inside, including Apple and Disney. There are going to be a lot of people listening today that work for those two companies. And you've also inspired teams that have shaped multiple iProducts, Star Wars experiences, and others. Some of your clients' very short list includes, I don't know, little-known companies like Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Coca-Cola, LinkedIn, Nike. I mean, the list goes on, but I'm pretty sure everybody listening recognizes those names. And the reason, main reason we're here to chat today is because you're the co-author of the new book, Brave Together, Lead by Design, Spark Creativity, and Shape the Future with the Power of Co-Creation. So Chris, I'm very, very excited to have you here to ultimately answer the question, which is boiled down into one sentence in your book, and it's the reason we're here today. How can we shape a creative work life that we love? So Chris, can I thank you enough for taking the time to be here today?
It's great to be here. Thanks, Zach. I'm excited and looking forward to diving in.
So the way that this came together is the universe decided to literally put you in my lap, or at least in my inbox. Your publicist reached out and I took a quick look at the message. I asked my podcast producer to take a look, thinking this sounds like it might be the right fit. The book was sent to me and I basically open up the book having asked Debbie, what am I going to be talking about with Chris? You had me at the third sentence in the dust jacket. And the question was, why do companies kill creativity? And I was like, yes, I want to talk about this so badly. That's going to be the major crux of our conversation. But before we get right into the weeds, I think it's really important to understand a little bit more about you and your own personal hero's journey, because it really shapes a lot of the work that you do now. And there was one line that you shared about the journey that you had that I think really is going to resonate with my listeners, that resonated with me. And you said, "I didn't want to be stuck animating somebody else's ideas." So let's use that as the teeing off point for your own creative journey that led to you doing all the consulting work, the writing, and why you're here today.
Yeah. Thanks again, Zach. So to sum it up, kind of in short, you know, this was something that goes back to, I say, my earlier days of, you know, just being young, and I wanted to do, you know, do things right. I was on the kind of the Boy Scout path, you know, get the Eagle Scout, get all the merit badges, and then knock out one dream at a time, you know, academically, everything. And, you know, what could possibly go wrong? Well, you know, a lot, actually. So fast forward, I ended up on I was studying at BYU, which at the time wasn't really known for animation at all. This was their experimental run at it. But they hired in somebody from Disney, and I realized, like, I'd known for a while that I wanted to work at Disney. And so I wrote a letter to Roy Disney, and I said, "Hey, love to get a job there. Can you help me out?" You know, that summed up the letter. Sent it off. And then, another 3 or 4 months go on. I forgot about that letter. And I got a phone call, though, one day. This lady says, "Hi, it's Lisa. I'm a recruiter at Disney. Roy said to talk to you." And, you know, all the wishes upon a star were coming true. Pixie dust everywhere, was flying everywhere. And you imagine anybody gets this moment, and it's like, this is it. I'm done. Like, I'm good. That's the dream. But my heart was saying telling me otherwise. And it was a really strange moment right then to feel that way. I didn't exactly know why at the time. But I told her thanks, and I got off the phone, and it felt really weird. But what I didn't know that was happening was there were things they were orchestrating, but I realized I was burned out of that idea, right? I didn't want to be in a sweatshop. I talked to some animators at Disney, and some that were very successful. And, you know, one of the guys, he was the hamster in Bolt, and he was also an animator, done incredible work. But he told me, he's like, you know, he didn't have a family. He's just like, "Yeah, this isn't really conducive to my family sometimes. You know, it's busy and I sleep on the floor at a friend's house sometimes." I'm like, what? This guy seems to be the epitome of animation success, or at least somewhat of it. So a lot of those things factored in. And I just realized, like, okay, right company, but this isn't going to work this way. And, you know, so then I just set out on an exploration. I wondered, like, what was this? Exactly. Right. Part of it had to do with, I don't want to just, you know, being kind of a sweatshop, you know, cranking out in between lines, you know, or in between drawings, but it was more than that. And more than anything, it was, I don't just want to try to go it alone anymore, or just be in pursuit of that dream. You know, there are a lot of people I noticed that were after their dream and they were not happy. You know, they were struggling and just burned out or disillusioned, right? Because they go down a path. And I mean, like that guy, like, he didn't hate his job, but he wasn't like excited about it. It surprised me. So, you know, I also realized there's something I don't know that's out there in the universe that I need to know before I can really move things forward. Yeah.
So what was the thing that you went from not knowing that you didn't know to knowing that you didn't know to now knowing?
Well, it was a strange path too, because after that happened, the Disney thing, I didn't really know what to do next. Right. I knew that was a no, that was a hard no answer. But sometimes we get hard no answers and we don't really have clarity about what the yes is. And that was true for me. So I had a friend at the time, and we, you know, had some ideas about certain things, and suddenly we just started to connect dots. I was connecting with different mentors or people that I admired. So like Don Bluth, that was an animator, you know, American Tail, a lot of the classics. He left Disney years before. And just people like that, that I was curious about, what's their story, right? Behind the curtain, like, what did they do? What was it about them? You know, because usually you just see the product of success. You see what they are, and everybody just fawns over that. And then you don't really know all the blood, sweat, and tears it took to get there. And so that I was curious about that about a lot of people. And he and I had this idea, which was, well, what if we start connecting people with mentors, like their dream people, or they connect with their people that they admire, and they dig in and figure out what's the story behind the curtain, but the real story. And so, you know, that was one way that, so we created what we call the International Mentoring Network. It was kind of an experiment. We had another friend who was a developer, and this was like early days of even like early social network days. So we were just testing stuff, but we launched it kind of a garage experiment. And next thing we know, we're featured in Fast Company, you know, Entrepreneur. And, you know, things were moving that we didn't even understand how this was moving. It was really like an open source mentoring experiment. And it was also a platform for us to do the same thing that we were suggesting other people could do. And I kind of did that with the Roy Disney thing, but, you know, that was different because I didn't pursue it. So my friend, he was curious, like he wanted to connect with Jack Welch, right? CEO of GE at the time. He did. And learned his story, got his experiences, but we'd also share these with the community. So the idea was you could open the floor, have a mentor on a call, and just have, you know, 10, 20, or however many people on the call, and just they could ask questions or listen. You could share the story online after. So we had people like Stan Lee, right, who created Spider-Man and, you know, Fantastic Four, all that stuff. Stephen Covey, who was somebody I'd always admired. He wrote the 7 Habits book. And, you know, we got crazy and we launched a thing, a campaign called the Get in Their Shoes campaign. We asked these mentors for their shoes and we auctioned them off on eBay with a mentoring kind of experience, you know, 30 minutes or an hour. And, you know, that was kind of innovative way, I guess, to just kick off this idea of this different approach to mentoring. But it was all really a learning exercise for me about, wow, what happens when you get a few passionate people in a room with an idea that could definitely change them, but could also potentially, you know, change people's lives and maybe even change the world. And, you know, that was where I'd say the inception of what's now become the book in some way kind of started, because I didn't really know that before. I was trying to do my own stuff and, you know, figure it out my own way. And that's one way to do a career. But I think what I learned was, it's an amplifier. It's an accelerator, right? For a creative, for a leader, for anybody, build a team, you know, build a brain trust. You know, Ed Catmull talks about this in his book, Creativity Inc., you know, the Pixar founder. But you can do that with your career. You can do that with your life. You can do that with your family. Yeah.
It's so odd how many parallels there are to your earlier journey and my journey where it is now. Mine's almost kind of flipped in the opposite direction, where I started and very much went down that path of solo success, being the creative in the room that don't bother me. I'm going to figure this out myself, you know, four walls and no windows, going that path for over 20 years, getting to very high levels of success. I don't have an Emmy or an Oscar, but outside of those external versions of success, I've done pretty well as a Hollywood film and television editor. Mm. Only then to realize one of the reasons that I got to where I am is because I built a team around me and I found mentors and I learned their stories. And I've now built an educational platform where I teach people how to build those relationships and reach out and have those conversations, which leads me to the question that I have now, which is with just this quote unquote experiment, how the hell are you getting Stan Lee and Jack Welch and all of these names on these calls to share their experiences? You must be doing something right.
That's a good question. We had a lot of people ask that, you know, and there were other people we connected with, you know, Dave Copperfield, the magician, a lot of people. But, you know, the thing was that I think there was a sense of bold and crazy, like those ingredients can be powerful. Like you mix those together and you mix unconventional approaches together. Like you just show up somewhere where they are, right? It's hard for them to say no. Or you send a really thoughtful email that would frame the question, but it was also, we were a nonprofit. So I think that maybe factored in. It was like, hey, this is all about just making others the mission. It's altruistic. That was a good hook, I think. And yeah, I mean, we found ourselves, I just found myself like pinching myself. One of the funniest ones was my friend sets up this call with this guy. I don't even know who it is, but he's like, oh, this guy's big. He's doing a bunch of stuff. You know, he's like, you got to hop on. And I'm like, what's his name? It's like, oh, Tim Ferriss. I'm like, I don't know what this guy is. What did he do? You know, who's this guy? And this was like, you know, before he got really big.
Yeah.
And then he sent me some stuff about, you know, I think his book had just come out, something. I just wasn't paying attention. So, I mean, his book was big later, but in the 4-hour work week. But I just dug in. I was like, I don't really understand what all this is, but okay. So I hop on the call and I start asking these random questions. And, you know, here we are talking to Tim Ferriss. I don't know who he is. I end up talking to Jimmy Wales, who started Wikipedia, right? But same thing. We're just on a call and hey, Jimmy, you know, how did you start this thing? Oh, people, you know, were skeptical. They thought it was crazy. You know, who's going to post stuff for free, you know, on online? Like, nobody's getting paid. Like, this isn't a model, a business model. He's like, no, I'm going to try it. So, you know, you learn things like that. Or Tim had his ideas about productivity that were kind of crazy at the time. A lot of them have been adopted since, you know?
Yeah. Now everybody's doing them, right? They all think they're the innovators and they're all just copying what everybody else is doing, which is actually another theme maybe we'll talk about later, about all these personal life hacks and productivity hacks and how I think you and I feel very, very similarly about all of those. But I don't want to go down that tangent quite yet. So continue.
That's a whole thing. Yeah. I think, I guess the shorthand of, you know, how did we connect with these folks was just a blend, you know, of crazy, brash naivete, and having a pretty good reason, you know, to connect, that they could feel that mattered, right? Because like they have pretty, unlimited, but, you know, relatively unlimited resources and not unlimited time. So they think like, oh, well, this has got to be important. And so to grab their attention, and sometimes we would use, like Tim actually Ferriss says this, you know, throw a question at them, right? Sometimes that works too. You know, kind of leave them with some intrigue. But yeah, we've continued to connect with folks. I moved on from the mentor network was a great experiment. Of course I got married and my wife's like, yeah, it's great. You're out changing the world, but you got to pay the bills, you know? So, you know, reality came knocking and that was a turning point for me to get into the corporate world. And I didn't have an answer as to what that would be either. So I'd studied animation for my undergrad. I'd done some work in some publishing companies and, you know, some animation stuff. But I came to the realization that, the hard thing for me was I would sit during, you know, university classes. I'd be in art classes. I'd be thinking about business. I'd be business class. I'd be thinking about art. So I was just this weird kind of misfit, you know, situation, right? And I don't claim to be like Albert Einstein level, but it was encouraging when I heard him say, I didn't hear him say personally, but I read it. He's like, the physicists say I don't belong with them. The mathematicians say I don't belong with them, right? And this is a theme in our book too, is about misfits. And I think what we're seeing in the world today is far more creatives that feel like they don't fit the bill, you know, and to your point about why do companies kill creativity? Well, they've been reestablishing and trying to reframe and reset this notion that it's a scientific exercise. And all of us that feel differently, that it's about humanities or creativity, which when you look at the companies that are the most successful, that's everything they're doing, right? Nike's about humanity. Apple is about humanity at its core. Right? Microsoft has become about humanity. Satya Nadella is that kind of leader. And so that's really what is winning. But there's a lot of companies that they don't notice that. And it's frustrating, right? Because we bump up against that stuff and it's painful. Yeah.
Well, this idea of impact, change, humanity just brings me back to one of my favorite quotes. This goes back to this idea of the misfits, or this idea has got to be bold or crazy. One of my favorite quotes comes from Steve Jobs, who you talk a lot about in the book. And his quote is, those that think they're crazy enough to change the world are usually the ones that do. Right. And yep. I don't know about anybody else that's listening. I would presume there's a high probability that they can relate, but I know for me, exact same experience. Every single sector of my life, I always feel like I don't quite fit in here. I don't quite fit to the mold of whether it's the editing post-production community, or like I spent 5-6 years training for American Ninja Warrior, love this community, but I don't quite totally fit in. Or, you know, going to a play date group for dads with their kids, I don't quite fit in. And I realized that for me, it wasn't about the sense of I specialize in this one thing and this is my group or my tribe. It's the intersection of all of them where I feel like that's where I really fit in, is when all of those things converge and come together. And I talk all about this idea of this intersection and how I really believe that with the advent of artificial intelligence and everything going on with the various creative industries and the economy, that it's the generalists like us, the multi-hyphenates, we're really going to start rising to the top, because specialists don't really fit in anywhere anymore. I think that's a very common theme for creatives, especially the more specialized you are, the more prone you are to replacement by technology. Mm. And there's so much about your own personal narrative that I can resonate with, where you're like, well, I was into this, but I was into that and this other thing, and I don't really fit in anywhere. So I'm curious whether it's similar to me or not, whether if for a long time that was really to your own detriment, or you felt like you were doing something wrong.
Yeah, I hit a wall like after the Disney thing. And I realized like, I don't know how to move forward. And you know, I mentioned the mentor network, that was one way. But ultimately, what I realized was it wasn't a single path, but that it was a set of building blocks, like Legos, right, that were going to fit together. And for me, it was something related to creative, right, art, something related to business leadership, and then something related to, you know, teaching or truth, you know, stuff. And so I was like, these things, combining them, you know, and I didn't know how they would combine, but you know, that's the part of the journey, right? The exploration is how this stuff starts to fit. So yeah, I mean, I think going back to what you're saying about, you know, most people, well, I saw this video, this reel of Kevin, you know, the shark, and you know, we have our own opinions about sharks in the book.
Got a whole chapter about Shark Tank, which was fascinating, but yeah, continue.
Got to shatter the Shark Tank. I mean, this notion, you know, it's like, and actually this has to do with shattering something too. Okay, so he says in this video, and it wasn't long ago, by the way, that people would say, hey, you know, kids got to learn coding. Everybody's got to learn coding, coding, coding. I have friends that are doing Web3 and everything else, and they're like, I have an entire team of an organization of bots that are coding. Now, do they need to learn coding? Okay, yeah, they're an architect. But Kevin, in this video, he says, you know, I used to tell people, if you're talking about hiring, engineers, engineers, engineers. You know, we saw like Steve Ballmer on stage, like shouting that and sweating, you know, classic Microsoft video. But he said, now what I say to people is creatives, creatives, creatives. He said, the problem now is though, it's flipped where you can't afford these guys, right? They're getting paid six figure that, you know, 200K. And he's like, but they have a niche. But here's the interesting thing about that. Engineering, that's usually at least partly degree oriented, educational. There's experiences that tied to that. And yeah, there's experiences tied to any career. But creatives, you could just come out of the wilderness with an idea, right? You could just have something that you're just, that is, you know, and it's uniquely you. I think the originality potential of creatives is very high. And we're in a world, to your point with AI, that has all kinds of, I mean, that creates all kinds of possibilities and challenges. Also in the creative community. But what it does is, I think as a civilization advances over time, which we have, we go beyond efficiency, we go beyond effectiveness. And then what's next? Well, it has to do with creativity. And we believe it's co-creation. So it's an advanced level of creativity that also requires partnership and leadership to do it. But again, the great companies do this. You know, the great people, the cultures we love, right? Where we love to be, those moments that we feel something different, we've all had. We're like, we look back and we're like, what was that best experience that I had? It's usually had to do with the team, right? I mean, to your point, with those teams where you're just creating something awesome. And, you know, you can have this in a family, you can have it in any organization.
So this idea of co-creation is clearly a really big central theme of your book. And one of the charts, of the many charts that are in the book, that I gravitated to almost immediately was the efficiency, effectiveness, co-creation. I'm like, that's the epicenter of what I want to talk about. But I want to get there by taking maybe not a circuitous path, but I want to go a little bit backwards. And I want to dig even deeper into this idea of why companies and why businesses kill creativity. Because I think there's two very different ways to approach this, but you've literally written the book on it. So I want to get your take. When I read that question, what I really read was how companies kill creativity. So if somebody came to me and said, what's your opinion of how a company kills creativity? I talk about this all the time, where for me, as a film and television editor or a creative, it doesn't matter if you're a composer or a writer or whatever. So let's create the worst possible environment imaginable for you to do your job well. We're going to put you in a small dark room. We're going to take away the windows. We're going to make you work 14, 16, 18 hours a day. You're going to be completely and totally sedentary. And we're going to give you ridiculous deadlines that create such a high amount of stress that you have no room for free thought. You want to access the default network of your brain and take a break? Do that on your own time. You're on the clock, right? So that to me is, those are examples of how companies kill creativity. But what I want to know is, why would companies kill creativity? What's in it for them to kill it? And am I just interpreting the question wrong? Or do you feel that there's a difference between the two?
Yeah, I think so. Ed Catmull is in a Creativity Inc. book. He references something that's interesting. I think that relates to this. He's relating it to the creative side of, you know, and in fact, specifically Disney versus Pixar. So as they're integrating Pixar, and he talks about the beast versus the baby, right? And the beast is the machine. The beast is, we've got a business that's running and we got to feed the beast. And, you know, there's truth to that. You know, you have to have a margin, you got to have revenues. But if we ignore the baby, or if, you know, let the baby die, it's like, that's not good, right? We've got to have something that, and that's the, I think what we're seeing now is there's all these babies that need attention, and they're great ideas. They're actually going to power the future. But I think we have a lot of the beasts in organizations that are ignoring that, or they're scared, or they're just so used to doing things a certain way. I mean, like Disney, when they fired, you know, Lasseter, or like they do these things where it's like, no, 3D is not going to work. You know, it's like, well, why? Because they just stuck in the machine, right? They didn't see the future at the time. So I think there's a lot of things like that that could be the reason why. And then when you get to individuals and leaders, particularly, well, a lot of these guys have been trained, men and women, to think business. This is why executives, when they get involved in creative stuff, it tends to be messy, right? And they just got notes that are crap, right? And then it's like, why are they, or, and it's usually just a knee-jerk reaction thing, or it's a power play, or it's a rank poll thing. Eisner started to do that at Disney, didn't go over well. But I think when they let things loose, you know, one example of this that I love is, you know, the first real big stab at Marvel movie, which was Iron Man. And you had Favreau and, you know, Jeff Bridges went on a podcast talking about this. And he's like, I'm so used to having a script, always, right? Always have a script. He's like, I don't like to go in anything, you know, without that for a movie. And yet for Iron Man, he said they went in, him and Robert Downey Jr. and Favreau, they're in a trailer and it's like, there's no script. And Favreau's like, what would you say there? What would you say? Okay. And they're switching parts and doing this whole thing. And then the suits are in the room. I don't know if this is Kevin Feige or whoever, these guys, right? And they're like, no, he wouldn't say that. That guy wouldn't say that. And yet they're just, what Jeff Bridges said is, he's like, Robert Downey Jr. is just riding this wave. Favreau's riding this wave, right? Which is the wave of co-creation. And he starts riding this wave, Bridges, even though it's uncomfortable. It's like, this is weird. And he's like, here you have this $100 million movie, like hundreds of millions of dollars going into this. And if it fails, by the way, there is no Marvel Universe, right? I mean, at least for a long time. I mean, it's not going to work the same. And so, you know, they're kind of pushing back. And that's in a creative environment. They're pushing back on the suits. So I think it's a good lesson in how do you do things that are not just unconventional, but they're co-creative. And they bump up against those walls. You know, one of the other things about Steve Jobs was like one of my favorite videos. He's got his beard. He's in the wilderness. You know, he's left Pixar, or no, Apple, not left, kicked out mm-hmm. into the wilderness. His hero's journey, right? And he says in that video, he's like, you know, we just get used to like just bumping up against these walls, all these things in the universe. And we're just used to seeing all this stuff. But, you know, it was all made by some person. It's no smarter than you and me. And, you know, we realize that. And when we ask, the other thing he talks about asking, he talks about calling the, you know, person at HP or the founders, getting parts and then getting a job there. So we're like we were talking about earlier, connecting with people, but it's also about asking the universe, right? What if questions, and what if we build things differently? What if it doesn't have to be a boring meeting that we sit in and just stare at the clock, or, you know, hate the agenda, or it's some leader just playing a role, right? They're like, it's like a Shakespearean play and they're just up there saying what they have to say. I mean, it's not even Shakespeare, it's boring. So pick a, you know, some movie that's, I don't know, but it's not what we want. It's not the experience that we're looking for to feel, you know, activated. But it is possible. Yeah. Well,
my sincerest apologies for the interruption, but if you're a creative professional who spends long hours at your workstation, not only is the following promo not an interruption, but listening has the potential to change your life. Because working with a topo mat underneath you at a height-adjustable workstation is a game changer. Let's learn a little bit more from Ergo Driven co-founder and CEO Kit Perkins, creator of the topo mat.
The topo mat is the first anti-fatigue mat designed specifically for standing desks. The real benefit of a standing desk is movement. We found bringing in this cushioned terrain under your feet, your brain just subconsciously engages and you wander around and you get that movement at the standing desk that you need without even having to think about it at all.
People will come to me at an event or a panel and they'll say, I got the topo mat because of you. Even when they had a mat, once they used this one, it was a total game changer.
We've just heard time and time again that with topo, we've kind of hit the sweet spot that it's the right premium quality materials and a right shape that people are actually getting benefit out of this stuff.
You spend more time here than anywhere if you do creative work the way that I do. So I would rather be driving around in a Ferrari than a Ford Pinto. And I feel like this is the Ferrari of the standing mat.
One of the things you don't realize is that at a standing desk, your main interface to the world, your body's main interface to the world is the ground. If you're going to invest in anything at that Ferrari level, it should be what you're standing on.
Well, my goal is that for anybody that is a creative professional like myself that's stuck in front of a computer for inordinate amounts of time of their waking life, they're doing it standing on a topo mat. So you and I, my friend, one edit station at a time are going to change the world.
I like it. That's a utopian vision that I can get on board with.
If you're a creative professional looking for a simple and affordable way to stay active, energetic, and focused while spending long hours at your height adjustable workstation, I can't stress enough how important it is to have the right mat underneath you, which is why I continue to share the topo mat as my number one product recommendation. To learn more about the topo mat and purchase yours, visit optimizeyourself.me/topo. That's T-O-P-O.
This idea of building differently is definitely the direction that I want to go. And as long as we're on it, we're going to stand the thread of Steve Jobs, because Apple and Steve Jobs are obviously a core theme of this entire book. And I know that this was a stumbling point for me in the past. And I know it's been a stumbling point for a lot of people, especially those that consider themselves kind of grammar gurus, where for a long time it bothered me that the saying was think different. I'm like, no, it's an adverb. It's think differently. And then I read the Steve Jobs biography and I was like, oh, I get it now. And not only do I want you to help everybody interpret that might still not understand the difference between think differently and think different, but you helped Apple, their entire culture, make the transition from think different to different together. So I want to attack this a little bit more deeply, because this is the heart of this co-creation process.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good point too, because you're right. And that just shows, like, I guess the, you know, brash nature of like, hey, we're going to challenge the English language even, right? That's classic Apple. And, you know, being at Apple culture, I saw, you know, they do that. It's not just they talk about it, they live it, right? It's fundamental. They don't have mission statements on the wall. They live and breathe thinking different. And, you know, I think as an aspiration or as something that, I mean, clearly the products they build, there's collaboration involved. It feels like, you know, this is like a band, you know, like the Beatles, Steve would relate to. But I think the thing that's interesting is what started to happen when I was there. I was like, well, okay, you had all these people that knew Steve as a leader. And then you had all these leaders that were people, teams. I was told 70% that had been there 5 years or less. So the question was, how do we teach them Apple fast enough? And it was a very one-directional question, though. So I thought, okay, so you're assuming think different, you know, that's it, right? And we already got nailed down. Apple University was showing a lot of the artifacts of Steve on stage. And I mean, these are classics. So you're talking about the quintessential business leader. But to Ed Catmull's point in his book, most people don't cover the whole story arc. And I wouldn't say they ignored it, but that's a big deal, right? Like going from rough Steve to change Steve, he learned a lot. You know, Ed talks about this in his book, but we reference this as like, you know, Ed worked with him for 26 years, more than anybody else. And, you know, he got to see firsthand some of these behaviors that weren't great, you know, and in Hollywood, they glorified a lot of these, some of the movies that came out. And, you know, there was heartburn about this for some of, you know, Steve's family and other people, because they're like, that doesn't really capture it. And what it didn't capture was, it didn't capture the fact that this guy got kicked out of his own kingdom, right? You know, Walt Disney got a kick in the teeth when his Oswald the Lucky Rabbit got stolen. But, you know, Steve, it was his company. And, but he had lessons to learn. He was not matured in some ways. And so he had, you know, in starting Next and starting Pixar, he learned some compassion. He learned some empathy. And I think that helped contribute to the right ingredients, right? The right soil, the right things that you could plant the future of Apple upon. So of course he gets back and he clears up the SKUs. They get focused on what they need to do. And pretty soon it is one of the most valuable companies in the world. But when I got there, what they were struggling with was an existential question of, first of all, where's that person over the shoulder that has a definitive point of view that's telling us what to do, right? Steve. Tim was much more distributed power. Hey, sit back and listen. What do you think, right? And then you drive. But that's a different interaction, right? And so leaders didn't quite know what to do. And then this notion of, identity, right? Think different. That's a good identity. If the problems that were arising about friction in the system and problems of collaboration, again, 70% of people didn't know how to navigate sometimes, or at least they were newer. So they're trying to figure out, okay, those guys at the top know each other. They had their pre-existing relationships. And, you know, Apple's a company that focuses on secrecy. So they're not everybody's talking about the product. They are up there, but down here, how do we connect us 100 people with those other 100 people or 200, and they're not sharing this, they're not sharing that. So all these horizontal connections, you know, that require working together. And so we thought, okay, let's keep the strengths of thinking different and build on that by doing it together. And, you know, the way we did it was just, we're starting to dive into what are those future culture principles that, you know, kind of in an interstellar way. If this is the Matthew McConaughey of the future, you know, Cooper, that's pulling the old one, you know, to the future, or giving him advice, the old Apple, he's the future Apple. What is it? What are those things? What are those things that are going to be the guide points, the beacons, you know, the coordinates? And that was the exercise, was to get to what are the heartbeat future principles for Apple. Some of them had to do with sharing. Some of them had to do with sticking with the North Star, you know, and sharing was countercultural because it was like, oh, we're secrecy. But yeah, share smartly, but build these circles of sharing, right? Brain trusts. So we borrowed the notion of brain trust from Ed Catmull too, and fused it at Pixar. They had a camera brain trust. Well, what if we build one for AirPods? They're having challenges over there. Oh, what if we do it for iPhone? There's some struggles like trying to get to iPhone 10, which is a big deal. And if we don't solve for the antenna, you're gonna have a nice glorified iPod. So we got to get this right. Oh, wireless, we got to do that better too. There's all these things where you're like, wow, what if we're doing more brain trusts? And it wasn't that those elements weren't there. The ingredients were, but really bringing it together and being intentional, that was the work to do. And as we did, yeah, you had AirPods that it went from, you know, an idea that people thought was actually, frankly, inside the company, I'll say a little ridiculous. They knew it was possible. You hired PhDs and people that have written white papers. They're like, this is impossible. You can't do this. Like, well, that's why we hired you. You're going to help us do it. And the engineers are like, yeah, that's exciting. And so, but like the STEM in it, the designers hated. It's like, nobody's going to, oh, come on. Like, you know, of course it turns into a meme. People love it, you know. But then the idea of like, how do we iterate? How do we get better at this? Well, working different together, having brain trusts that partner differently together based on those principles and those coordinates, the quantum data, right, from the future, we could get there. And that's how we started getting there.
I want to dig a little bit deeper into some of these ideas and these core principles, and I want to pair them with kind of the contradiction or the opposite. So essentially, all these things that you're talking about that you brought to Apple or to other companies to create co-creation, I also want to see what the inverse is in the world of these more standard toxic work cultures. So I'll give you an example, and then you and I can kind of riff. We're going to kind of co-create on the fly. Yeah. See what I did there?
Yeah.
So for me, one of the core principles that's really important to me for any team that I work with, and it took me a long time to figure this out, but whenever, and it's been a while since I've actually interviewed to work for somebody else because I know largely do my own thing, but the number one question, whether I'm actually asking it or I'm trying to figure it out, is this a culture where the best idea wins or where your idea wins because you're more important and you get paid more? Those are two diametrically opposed ideas. And I've always said that if I'm working on something late at night and my door is open and the janitor comes by and says, that should be a close-up instead of a wide shot. In one culture, they shut the door and say, what do you know? In a culture I want to be a part of, I'm like, what? Oh, they're right. That is better, right? So that to me is an example of either co-creation or just this idea of the best idea wins versus the most important person's idea wins. Yeah. Give me some other examples of this contradiction between the toxic work cultures we're very familiar with and the inverse that we can work towards. Then I want to talk about how we work towards it.
Yeah. I mean, just how leaders lead, right? They may say, I mean, to your point, it's like, I'm the expert. I've got the, you know, I've seen companies where they have this, there's actually a notion where they would use it. I don't know if it's still happening, but there was a company I worked with. It was like answer first. They borrowed this from Bain, right? Consulting companies. They have the answer first, competence. You lead with the competence. And they use this example of the bicycle. It's like your first wheel should be the competence that you bring to the table. I think it's flipped, actually. It definitely is now, right? Because I have Google, I have AI, I have all these things, ChatGPT. They can spit out answers all the time. I don't need a guy or person, male or female, leading that is just an answer machine. What we need is people that are great at listening, that are leading with questions. You know, and how simple is that? Just to create some brave space and allow for someone to share thoughts and ideas and to feel empowered to do it. And that's not a threat, you know, to the boss or to the leader. It's actually powerful when they can, you know, feel like, wow, I, you know, or like Steve would say, I don't hire, now granted, to live up to it, that's another thing. But it was a wrestle. But, you know, we don't hire people to tell them what to do. We hire people to tell us what to do. And I felt that was true. Like my first meeting at Apple, I get in there and I know what, you know, because some companies you have to earn your seat, right? It's a few years, even like 6 months. I mean, so you just kind of wait to kind of graze around the edges. First meeting though, I'm sitting there and this is about performance management, their whole philosophy and all this stuff. So I don't think I have like really much to say because I'm like, I haven't learned process here. But the leader comes in who hired me and he just like slams his fist on the table. And he's like, this is crap. He's like, we got to change everything we're doing. It's like, Chris, you've been at Disney and Dell. Tell us what we need to do differently. And I just love the spirit of that, right? Like it didn't have to be like, oh yeah, I'm going to actually come out with some solution. And I would have all the context to even do that. But I felt like the spirit of that was really encouraging, right? Because it created that kind of misfitty, you know, and that's what they have, right? They have that anomaly culture that it's the rebels. Those kinds of things. I mean, meetings too, just by design, they're designed typically to be boring. They're designed to disengage people. They're designed to be top down. So reimagining meetings, you know, why can't it just be more flow? We talk about flow with art, right? When you're doing what you love, you're painting or you're playing sports, you know, you're reading things you love. Why can't we have that feeling at work? And why can't we have it, you know, that's the next level, which is the shared flow. You see those teams in sport that are just moving together, right? The Warriors, when they're playing a great game, you know, or other teams when they do. Yeah. That kind of thing. Those are some.
Yeah. And you kind of said this already. I want to dig into this even deeper because it's a core philosophy and principle of mine as well. If we're looking at the toxic work culture approach versus more the co-creation approach, It's I'm going to give you answers versus I'm going to lead with questions. This is actually a transition that I made in building my team, which is a little bit smaller than Apple. It's probably the size of one tiny corner of one building of one department. So it's a very, very small company. But we were struggling with figuring out, especially because we're 100% remote and we're distributed across, I think, four different continents and multiple time zones. It's hard for us to just get into a room and just chit chat and be like, oh, what do you got on the whiteboard over there? Right. Like it's much, much harder. And I think that a lot of people are struggling with this currently where it's harder to creatively collaborate with remote workflows. And the fundamental change that I've made that I think, and maybe Debbie or other team members would disagree, but I really believe that the fundamental change that's helped facilitate the creativity is that we frame meetings around questions, right? How can we solve this one problem and give people the time beforehand to think about it? Then the entire meeting is, what about this? Well, what about this? Well, what about this? Versus if I wanted to create kind of the more standard corporate environment, you all need to solve the problem. You do it this way, you do it this way, you do it this way. And I feel like, especially in the creative side of the industry where I was, and because you've been with Pixar and all these other companies, you've probably seen the difference between here's how you're going to do it versus how can you solve this problem?
Yeah, I think planting those seeds of questions is really powerful. You can send a question out a week in advance and then just let people marinate on that. You know, it creates a lot of space. You can lead with questions in the meeting without appearing, I think, to not knowledgeable or, and like, this is something too, that shows up in the world out there, right? It's like, I get burned out of it. Like there's a lot of books, right? I mean, self-help kind of gurus. It's like, there's just spitting out answers all the time. And usually it's about one thing, right? It's like, this is the expert at that thing. And, I don't think there's nothing wrong with being an expert, but there's tends to be more power in powerful questions. I had a friend, I worked with her at Apple. Her name is Lucky, of all names. She's very, awesome, just incredible thinker, smart, extremely smart, but like probably the best Socratic method applied I've ever experienced in my life. And she would just ask really probing questions and just really thoughtful questions and just wait, just create space, just let you sit in your thinking. And I really appreciate that. I think there's power in that and it's underestimated, it's underrated, right? For leaders, because we also feel that internal pressure to have all the answers. We feel the internal pressure to lead. Again, I think some of the best, I have my favorite leaders. He's been in the Air Force. He was a pilot for like 20 some years. And then he led this organization I was in. And I remember sitting with him and he's like, I had this question I needed an answer to. And I asked him and he goes, well, if you were me, like, what would you do? If you're me for a day, like, what would you do? And it wasn't a throwaway question. He was actually really curious. Like he wanted to know. And so when I shared that, then he just grabbed it in the air and we started co-creating the answer. And then we went after the solution together. And I think that's something that a lot of leaders could benefit from. That's the creative side, because it is creative, right? It's a creative act. I love like Rick Rubin's book, right? Mm-hmm. The creative act. I think leaders can benefit from that kind of space where they just say, this is a creative act. Leading there's an art to it. And yes, there's definitely science to it as well, but the art and creativity has been crowded out and it's been bullied for too long.
So now comes the next obvious question, at least for me, speaking of questions in the Socratic method, because that's the whole point of this podcast. All of this is a creative that's worked in the entertainment industry for well over 20 years. And whether it's Hollywood or Pixar or the tech industry, just where creative minds are coming together to solve problems. Everything you're saying makes perfect sense. Why are so few people actually doing it this way? Why is it so bass-ackwards?
I mean, this could be the same question inside of an organization where you're wondering, like, why isn't the culture different, right? And most of us have been there, right? Well, the house isn't on fire, right? It's like, well, they're making some money, right? They've had, like, they may be applying 1980s methodology, right? As far as business is concerned, and it's getting some results, right? Whatever that is, 20% margin, whatever it is. And you know, most people don't, they're not at a stage where they want to really change unless there's a pressure to that, you know, and this is the unfortunate, this is the challenge of life. This is the, I mean, our personal lives, like sometimes it's like the greatest growth happens in the valleys. Actually, you know, I'd say that's true, generally speaking, and then in companies too. But if that's true, you know, and granted, like the other part of this is we're talking about culture or the flow. Most leaders don't just stop and think about this. Like that hasn't been part of the education, of the leadership education, right? And by the way, we go back to Sir Ken Robinson. It hasn't been part of the educational system to begin with, right? Like why do schools kill creativity? I mean, why aren't they just getting into teams and building apps and building businesses in school? Like, why not? Because that's what they're going to do after. I mean, granted, there's always subjects and fair enough. But why not a blend, right? Why not an and answer hybrid to that? So these are the kinds of things, but I've asked these questions a lot of times in these different companies. And sometimes you emerge with, okay, like at Dell, we started this thing. It was like, let's get all these people together. It was a think tank, a platform. We called it Game Changers. We invited people from all over the organization. They've been there 20 years. They've been here 15 years, been there 5 years, been 2 years, just got there. And it's like, hey, here's our business challenges. Help us figure these out. And get into teams and boom, boom, boom. And, you know, it's kind of a shark tank exercise, less shark, more dolphins. And they start building, right? And pretty soon you got a guy, he's in his team, they create a $1 billion app for the company out of thin air, right? And you know, these are the kinds of things where, well, nobody really asked, right? So he's sitting in the corner for 20 years and yeah, he's doing his job. He's like, you know, pigeonholed into the screw, fits in the screw. It's like, yes. But what if there's like 10 other things he can do? I mean, I was in a meeting 20 years ago, 15. Thomas Friedman, right? The world is flat. They asked him at the very end, they said, what's the future? And he said, it's writing your job description. We're in that future. Except the powers that be want to keep clinging to that power. But the ones that see, they realize there's more to it than that. So I think that's something for folks to keep in mind.
There's a couple of things that I want to add on top of this. And I apologize if this is veering so completely away from the table of contents of your book, but to me, all of this is so fascinating. I could easily talk for 3 hours just about the one phrase, schools are killing creativity. Do not get me started. But I that's going to be veering so far off course. But I want to get back to this idea of why the companies are killing creativity and how they're so myopically not seeing this. And there's two discoveries that I've come upon. Well, one of which I knew for a while, this other one I came upon relatively recently. And it had nothing to do with studying companies. It had to do with studying just the cycles of history, this idea of the four turnings. I don't know if you're familiar with this concept, right?
Oh, yeah.
But with this idea of the four turnings and being in the fourth turning, I heard it on a podcast. I don't remember who was talking about it, but it was this idea of when it comes to governments and infrastructure, it seems like everybody's waiting for the perfect time to update the roads and build the new systems and put in the futuristic subways. Like in the US, the infrastructure is just laughably bad when you look at the infrastructure in other countries, right? And the question is, why wouldn't you fix all of this when things are good and you have all the money and you have a surplus? And the concept that was talked about that instantly everything made sense to me is that necessity is the mother of invention. It isn't until the entire building is on fire that you start thinking about fixing all the things that led to that, which then it all of a sudden made sense to me why every time I start a new project, I say, you realize we don't have enough time. You realize this is under budget and none of this makes any sense, but they're waiting until the building is on fire because then they have no other choice. That's when it all clicked to me. This is what's broken about the industry. And the reason I bring that up is because right now, the building's on fire in Hollywood. The building is on fire in all of global entertainment and the tech industry. This is where I see tremendous opportunity because now it's all falling apart. So now necessity becomes the mother of invention.
Yeah. And to your point, I mean, I love that. I love that you referenced the fourth turning. And for anybody, you know, that's a great recommendation because it's just like, it's something that you wouldn't expect. The book dives into both kind of the parallels of an entire history of civilization, and then also the history of, you know, the United States or globalization, you say. But like the notion of, yeah, crisis, right? The fourth turning is crisis, or that fourth phase. And we're definitely in that. I mean, I look back, it's like, well, the '80s, there was something like idealistic about it, you know, kind of grew up in that. It's like, you know, go out on your BMX bike and, you know, it's like, okay, just have fun, right? Be back by dark, you know, not today, right? Everybody's like freaking out about where their kids are. And life is so complicated and it's accelerated and it's complex. And then you add in things like AI and yeah, entire industries going down. I mean, we see the jobs reports of like, hey, it's pretty good, right? Blue collar, I think white collar has been majorly disrupted, right? I was at Comic-Con, you know, over there doing some speaking and talking to different, you know, writers and, you know, actually actors didn't show up because that was during the strike. But, you know, to your point, it was like uncertainty, right? And uncertainty is pain, right? It's painful. But in that pain is the opportunity to turn that potential energy, you could say, into kinetic energy that's powerful. And so what does it start to look like or shape? We don't know the answers to that. I mean, I'll say like just right there, I was talking to like Marvel creators and people that have worked on, you know, produced like, I don't want to say, well, maybe I will. So Secret Invasion, they made a public apology. They made a private apology to me for that, like to sitting through a half episode of that. and then Thor, whatever that was, the last one, four, I think. these producers that worked on it, they said they couldn't watch it all the way through. Hey, it's one of those where it's like, to me, it was like, this is two different movies. You got Christian Bale going method, you know, on villain, which is awesome. And then you've got like Chris Hemsworth and team and the Guardians like fighting like basically labyrinth puppets, you know, in a battle. It's like these two don't fit together. I mean, it's, you know, so hey, maybe somebody was, you know, doing some stuff when they were making the movie. I don't know, Taika Waititi, but like he usually nails it. Hey, and you know, he gets a free pass. Mandalorian, he did a great job. He did other great job, Ragnarok. But like, these are the kinds of things that I'm like, okay, first of all, I think there's an existential, not vacuum, but, and maybe that falling off was related to the strike itself. So to be fair, I don't know. And also just like, there's a bit of a burnout with the Marvel universe. So I'm not going to go there, but you're getting at is like, hey, there's this opportunity space for all this stuff and this technology that's been created. And that is the frontier is best led with a sense of co-creation, you know, and not just with the robots that are already here, but with teams that, you know what to do with that together and you build that together, you know, and then, yeah, what does it start to look like? Who knows? But like that kind of disruption, yeah, you're right. Like house is on fire. How many companies though are in the same boat and they don't know it, right? Some of the tech companies, we saw some major layoffs. So I think there's a recognition of like, hey, stuff has to change, you know, and there's also these signs of the future, right? Apple Vision Pro, I can talk about that now with my kids. It was a secret lab next to my office for years, but here we are. And those kinds of things where you're like, wow, what's that going to turn into? You know, experiences like the Void they had with, you know, using VR blend with AR or life, you know, and kind of putting people in the video game. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in all that that's interesting on the entertainment side. But as it gets back to also just general business, you know, I don't think a company has to necessarily be squarely in the creative space because they do what they do, right? But it is a question for leaders to answer seriously is to say, how do we go about this? How do we go about this differently? You know, and that's the mirror test, I think, of the future is, you know, yeah. What do we want the future to be? Ask ourselves, right? And then pursue that together, you know?
I have spent almost 10 years now raving about how much I love my Topomat, and I have finally discovered what I now consider the Topomat of desk chairs, the Core 360. The Core 360, spelled Q-O-R, is designed to keep me constantly moving while seated in an upright and balanced position. To learn more about how it works, let's hear from Core 360 founder, Dr. Turner Osler, about why he created the Core 360 Active Sitting Chair.
When you sit badly for many hours a day, and that's really what the problem is. It's very hard to make yourself get up and do jumping jacks every half hour. But if you just swap to a chair that requires you to be muscularly engaged in order not to fall off, it's an easy bar to clear.
For the procrastinators out there who hear all of the statistics and know how bad sitting is and it's the new smoking and they're thinking, that's something I'll worry about in a few decades, you're gonna feel the effects of having more energy at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or 4 o'clock in the afternoon that day.
And that's the whole point. Your core muscles will be stronger. You'll have less back pain. All of this will make you more available for the rest of the pursuits of your life, your kids, your hobbies, your whatever.
For those of us who need to practically live in front of computers to do our best creative work, the Core 360 is going to level up your game. Keep your body moving and keep the creativity flowing. To learn more and purchase what I consider to be the topomat of desk chairs, please go to optimizeyourself.me/core360. That's optimizeyourself.me/QOR360.
Well, the reason I wanted to bring up this idea of the fourth turning and the idea of things really have to break down and the building has to be on fire before anybody listens is that I think there's a lot of people that are listening or watching today, similar to me, where we've been shouting this from the rooftops for 10, 15, 20 years, right? The analogy that I always use on day one of a new project, I'm like, am I the only one that sees the tidal wave a couple of miles away? Like, is nobody going to prepare for the tidal wave? And then it hits and like, oh my God, there's a tidal wave. I'm like, yeah, I mentioned that 6 months ago and nobody listened. The reason I think this is so important is that I think everybody's going to be infinitely more receptive to solutions because now everything is broken. So anything that we might have said, well, what about this or that or the other thing? It was working just well enough and holding together. There's no reason to listen. Like as long as we're kind of meeting the bare minimums of the status quo, like Thor, maybe not the best thing in the world, but it's still making money. We're hitting the bottom line. But now Disney, the entire business, totally on fire. All these massive flops, one after another, they're going to be more receptive to feedback. Other companies will be. And I want to make sure as we have this very narrow, limited space as creatives, I want us to have solutions. I don't like bringing people problems. I want to bring them solutions. And if I'm an individual creative and I'm listening to this today and I'm thinking, yes, I want to bring this to my company or I want to bring this to the teams that I work with, what are practical solutions to transition from this is the way we've always done it to let's build systems of co-creation? What can I as an individual do to start affecting this change? Because I think people are finally ready to listen.
Yeah, I think it's actually really simple. It's been true for me in my experience, whether it was the Mentoring Network or at Dell, we started those things, or Disney or Apple. It just starts small. You find that one person, right? You know, like that video where the guy starts dancing and he's just crazy dance, right?
I've
and
the other used guy that joins more than in. Once. I love that video. Yes. Well, we'll link to it again, but I've used that half a dozen times to exhibit principles. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how it works, right? Because usually we'll think, oh, we got to do some big rollout or we got to do some big thing that's just going to have all this impact. And then we can also end up just stuck in our cave trying to design that perfect thing. And then it doesn't happen. So what we have to do really is, okay, you share, but you connect with those people that you feel are like-minded, right? Or that are asking the same question and they're kind of maybe angsty about it, right? They're wrestling with it. And they're like, I don't understand why, right? And maybe the verge of, you know, angry, could say, but like they're upset. Like they're done, right? They want things to change. And it's not skeptical or, you know, a sense of giving up, but it's wow. Like, hey, you're asking the same questions. I mean, at Disney, we started one of these and I call them brave conversations. We would meet with this Imagineer. We met with a futurist at Disney. We met with, one of the heads of diversity. Myself, we just do lunch meetings and then we just start venting about the culture. We're like, oh, this sucks about that. This is terrible. Why is this? These toxic bosses, whatever. And pretty soon though, after, you know, weeks or months of that, we started to shape ideas. And so futurist says, well, what if I did a session where I bring all these VPs and SVPs in and we think forward like 20, 25 years about the future of Disney. We start to build that. Like, yeah, that's good. You should challenge them. And we sort of started to help shape that. The Imagineer is like, I hate my boss. What do I do? And you know, that's a pretty funny story, right? Because, you know, the unhappy Imagineer, who would expect that, right? I mean, that's like the best job in the world.
If that isn't the best meme I could possibly imagine, like the grumpy Imagineer.
It's the story that it's the unknown story. We had it in the book. We pulled it out with our editor. It was one of those that like, but it's still, there's a story there because it's unexpected. The thing that happened though was here he is, he's just upset. And we had a conversation, right? We're in this brave conversation. He's just sharing. We're just sharing ideas, but we have nothing to do with his career. We're just weighing in, right? And eventually he gets this idea. It's like, because I don't know, somebody said it. Like, why don't you just go talk to the VP? Why don't you go talk to the head of the, I don't know, that's working around them. I don't know. Is that a good idea? Well, you're valued, right? Like you want to be successful here. You're getting put on crappy projects. Your boss is micromanaging you. You're going to leave, right? Otherwise, what do you have to lose? You know? And we're not answering the your earlier question about, you know, hey, if you're, but I think the question, it is in the sense, because he had the trust in this little circle of people who felt similar to him to share this. And then what he got out of that was the courage to go to his VP and say, hey, this is what's happening. Put it on the table. And what I really want to do, he said, was work on Star Wars, the edge, right? Like build this world of Star Wars. I want to do the Toy Story Land. I want to do this Avatar. I haven't been able to do these, you know, project. This guy, you know, and he's like, you know, he could be respectful about it, but obviously it was like, there's a boss situation. So VP says, hey, we really value you. I'll change your boss. You'll work on those projects. End of story, right? And these are the kinds of things. For me at the time, it was, I was bottling up this notion of like, I wanted to break out of Disney. And I didn't know it was Apple exactly, but that's what it was. So I started writing, and I started writing about Apple on LinkedIn. I connected with Adam Grant, some other people to like get on the platform early. And he was gracious enough to help with that. But it turned into actually sending the signal, the bat signal out into the universe. And then Apple saw this and I just started connecting with people. And the senior director calls me and he's like, hey, you're one of the 5,000 people of my connections. You're one of the five that I want to talk to. And I thought, well, how did I connect to this guy? Oh, I was just out blasting connections to people when I was talking about Apple. And you know, there's a lot of content on LinkedIn these days. So I don't know how effective a strategy that is now, but going back to your point about like, what do people actually do practically? Well, start a circle, but start, you know, or brave conversations really could be with one person and start to see where those lead. And then those conversations could be co-creative conversations that can turn into co-creative builds or brave builds where you start to build things that are different. And this could be in industries that are otherwise not creative, right? It could be like, hey, you guys build toaster ovens. Okay, what if we start just connecting and talk, you know, wow, those ideas that are just latent, you know, who's been taught, who, you know, or like Brad Bird did Pixar. It's like, oh, well, who's working on hair? Well, nobody's going to make hair in 3D. It's impossible. It's never been done. Oh, these guys are crazy. They're in the cave trying to do that. They're nuts, right? And Brad's like, I want them on the team. Let's get them, you know? So you find misfits too on the edges. Scott Belsky at Adobe, chief product officer, he talks about getting to the edge of reason. And I think that's a good notion, right? They're dealing with Firefly. There's a lot of things you can do and build off of, you know, at the edge of reason without going crazy, you know?
Yeah. It's funny. You've named at least five people that I've also either connected with or they're on my dream list of connections, which tells me that we went from who's this person in my inbox? And this could be an interesting conversation to finding that epicenter of the intersection of all of these generalized skills and interests and experiences that we have. It's so interesting how that just happens. So that's me putting a pin in. I think you and I are going to need to chat afterwards. Because there's a lot of intersection where I think there's a lot more we could talk about well beyond this conversation. And like I promised you before we started, we're going to get to minute 89 and I'm going to be about 10% into my notes. I'm about 5% into my notes, but I'm loving this way better than anything that I prepared. I want to come back to this idea for a second of practical solutions. And I want to share my experience of, and again, for anybody that doesn't know what we're talking about, I'll put a link to the video of the guy in the field at the concert and understanding human nature and how you can affect change. This is literally the way that my entire business started, is that I had a standing desk at my job. And there were other people that were talking about standing desks, but nobody in my industry was really using them yet. And I would tell them, if you're not going to provide me with a standing desk that's height adjustable, I'm going to bring my own. And literally on day one of my new project, I carried in a giant desk. And they're like, didn't we furnish you with a workstation? I said, yeah, but it's not a standing workstation. I want to be able to go up and down. So I was the only one. I was the outlier. I was crazy. Then all of a sudden, a couple of days later, hey, what's with your desk? I saw you walking down the hall. What's that all about? So I show them, like, ooh, I want that too. Mm-hmm. So then they would call the facility and then they'd say, well, wait, I see you're taking walks in the afternoon. We're all eating lunches at our desk. What's that about? Then all of a sudden that became a conversation. Then it was a conversation I had on somebody else's podcast. Then I started my own podcast talking about it. And all of a sudden it just exploded. I'm like, what is happening here? I was that one crazy guy dancing in the field. And what I've been saying for well over 10 years is that if you want to affect change, if we're going to talk about the entertainment industry, just to kind of keep it to one sector, you can't expect the change is going to happen from the top down. We're not going to fight for one contract that has one provision that's going to change the culture of our industry. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't fight for contractual protections, but at the same time, if we really want to affect change, it's me and the person I'm sharing a wall with and the person down the hall and the person down the hall, they disperse to the next job. And it's the person on the other side of their wall and the other side of their wall, which becomes more challenging, you know, in a post-pandemic Zoom society, but it still happens largely the same way.
Yeah, it's interesting too, like, because, you know, in today's world where, you know, so much happens that is so big and global, like in a tweet, in a moment, and now it may be, you know, just a short fizzle and it's there, or it hits and it's gone. But what the reality is behind all this is, we talked about humanities earlier, right? Or they're people, right? And we as people, you know, can affect change. We can make an impact. This dawned on me deeper than probably any other time to that point when we were doing that work at Apple, and I felt like, okay, we nailed it with these particular organizations, like the camera team who does incredible work on the camera technology. We nailed it with this wireless team. And I told this partner of mine, Caroline, I was like, hey, let's roll this out to everybody, right? We got to get this everywhere in the organization, right? Working different together. We got to do that now and just roll it out, right? You know, put it on a banner, blast it. And, you know, yeah, there's HR programs or programs and leadership programs that do that, but they don't do very well. They go flat, right? Because it's a corporate initiative, even at Apple. And by the way, that is the challenge, because people are like, what really matters to them? Well, what matters is what they've co-created. So we just took the approach of like, no, let's make it organic. We're sitting in this reflection pond. There's a reflection pond inside of Apple Park in Cupertino. And it's one of the coolest places. It's like a meditation space. And there's trees and, you know, bushes and rocks. And Caroline says to me, well, no, it's like this ecosystem right here, right? We've put the right pieces in place and it's like a garden. It's just going to grow. And she was right, right? It was organic. And, you know, maybe it also takes the right culture to be conducive to that. You know, there's another story that, and as far as impact that's related to this, and these are both big titans of industry. One time, not long ago, Elon Musk was on a Twitter tirade, you know, raging about the App Store. And he challenges Tim Cook to, you know, essentially a Twitter cage match. I call it that, you know, and he calls him out, right? Calls out Apple. It's their problem. And, you know, most leaders would have their reaction, right? That are kind of thinking at that level. No, but not Tim. Tim's kind of the Zen monk Buddha, you know, kind of up there. And so that's not how he thinks. He actually invites Elon to that reflection pond, you know, to Apple Park. He tours them and then they go to the reflection pond and they're standing there. And Elon takes a video of it and he posts online himself later. Look, you know, Tim Cook and I just met. We're all good. Here's the video. Like, so he answered his own question. Cage match, Elon versus Elon, right? Who wins? I guess Tim Cook. And at the end of the day, like, that was about principles, right? And it's about two people coming together. And that's the simplicity. We can have a massive impact in the world, right? It's what Elon's got, 140 million followers, however many Tim has. The reality was, we don't have to be fighting. We could be peacemakers, but you can also build stuff and start really small with just one person at a time. And that's true of every endeavor, you know?
Yep. And I agree with that wholeheartedly. And now I want to add a couple of layers of practicality to it. So let's assume somebody's listening. Maybe it was me 10, 12 years ago. That's they're the outlier with the standing desk or whatever it is. And they say, you know what? I think I might be the first person that's going to stand up, that's going to, you know, dance crazily until everybody joins me. And I want to have a brave conversation. I have no idea how to do that or where to start. Give me some, just like some baby steps. If I want to go from, this sounds like a great idea, but I don't know how to approach it, or I don't have the confidence to do it, to actually starting to lead this change with just one person or two people, and not worrying about, I'm going to change Hollywood, but I'm going to change the culture of my floor.
Yeah. Test the waters, like build relationships. That could be hard for introverted folks, but if you just test the waters and are putting in the effort to connect, and that could even happen on Zoom. You just set aside 30 minutes with someone, right? And it could just be like, hey, I just want to connect with them. I just want to get to know them. And, you know, you, as our friend Randy Nelson, who started Pixar University, says, be more interested than interesting, you know, and dive in to people's lives. And as you do, you might find, well, we don't agree on enough, and maybe that's not really where the momentum's going to happen with this, but I respect them and I got to know them a little better. That's good. Or somebody else, you come out of it and you think, wow. And sometimes it's people that have been through similar experiences, right? So sometimes, like, you started the company around the same time, right? Or you're wrestling with the same problem, right? Let's say per industry, and it's, hey, yeah, the sky's falling on creatives. Like, hey, we have that in common. Like, let's talk about it. You know, you just test these conversations and kind of see where the bravery in the conversation can lead. Usually it'll turn into something, you know, and fuel, right? Could be. And if it is fuel for the future, then you'll know. It's like, that's turning into something else. Now we're talking about, what can we actually do with this?
Well, this reminds me of a quote, and I can tell just by the structure of the book that you and Ian, your co-author, you clearly have an affinity for quotes. And the quote that this just reminded me of is the African proverb, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. I use that all the time. And this is the perfect example of, like you said, you pick the one person down the hall or in the upper left-hand corner of your weekly Zoom call or whatever it is. You're like, I think they're feeling what I'm feeling, right? It's not about, here's all the solutions and I've got a five-point bulleted plan and agenda I'm going to send to the VP. It's, let's talk. Am I the only one? I'm not. You too? Oh, maybe so you're telling the other, he's been talking to you about that? Oh, okay. Right. That I've felt that at a much more organic level. And it's what's led to me building this platform and teaching all the things that I teach, because one person at a time, it's, oh, I'm not the only one that feels that way. Oh my God, I feel so much better. So I think that that's so important. But there's one factor that I think is necessary for us to talk about before we leave. And I was hoping to have more time for it. This literally could be an entire part two of our conversation. Pretty much everything we've talked about so far has been within the realm of what you call tier one. I work for a company. There's a whole other vast universe of, screw this, I'm going out on my own and I'm going to be an entrepreneur. And you talk about that as tier two. Mm-hmm. And that's very much the world that I was in for years. And I kind of am still in. But then there was this third tier that never occurred to me. Like, this is your version of Inception, where until going through your book, I'm like, it never even occurred to me there was a blend of these. So at least briefly, talk to me a little bit more about tier one, tier two, and then this whole new co-creation phase, which is an either or.
Yeah. We see this most prevalently probably in places like LinkedIn, where there's this battle, right, that ensues between, and it's not really spoken this way, but it shows up where, like, entrepreneurs are like, hey, look at me, right? I'm pursuing my dream, right? And, you know, and there's extreme versions of this that are a little more caricatured, right? Where guys like live streaming, the Lambos are behind him. They're probably rented, right? He's got a house behind him, but it's probably
Grant Cardone. Something stuck in my throat. Sorry.
There you go. It's probably all green screened, right? You might have AI family, who knows, right? But here he is. And then, you know, but there's that tension, right? Because then on the other side, employees could say, well, I got the security, I got the safety, the comfort of, like, what I do. But what we're seeing more and more of is this innate creative sensibility, this inner voice that wants to be, that wants to express in all of these people, right? So whether you're inside of a company, yeah, it might be like, okay, I have this talent. And it might not be like, hey, I want to build a whole business out of it, but there's something there, right? There's something there. And then entrepreneurs, I mean, they're not wrong, right? As far as, like, hey, that's more autonomy, more freedom. But, you know, ultimately, what are you building? Right. And if you look at like, how does the Shark Tank play out? Well, ultimately, they start building an empire. Right. And then that starts to look like what was tier one. Right. So it's like, hey, you got a system that you've built. Nothing wrong with that. But is it the full answer? And so the question that left us to, and you know, you could be inside of a company saying like the examples we shared about, hey, let's build something. You get the motion to do that. Or you're outside and you're doing that as an entrepreneur. But the point is there's a synthesis, right? Because thesis, this is kind of Hegel's dialectic. Thesis is employee. Antithesis, entrepreneur. And most people would say it ends there. No, the synthesis is the co-creator. And you can be a co-creator in either context and you can do it very well. And by the way, you could blend both. It's possible. So I think finding ways to be a co-creator. And by the way, you know, Covey would say, how do you change behavior? The best way is to change people's perception of their role. And so how do you change the dynamics of a leader or a parent even to their son or a leader to their employee. What if they just rethought the relationship? What if it's not, hey, this person's my employee or this person's my, you know, whatever. It's like they're a co-creator. I'm a co-creator. Right. So that example of that leader from the Air Force I talked about earlier, he was being a co-creator. Or if as a parent, I show up with my son and he's wrestling with some challenge. If I show up as just, dad here to tell him what to do. That's one approach. Or it could be like, what do you think you should do? Right. Or partnering, right. Co-creating the answer. He's bringing forward things, you know, and teenagers don't always have all the answers clearly, nope. but I think they appreciate a co-creative approach more. And it's not to say you can do this all the time, but I guess getting back to the business side, it really is being a co-creator as tier three. We call it, you know, shorthand T3. And you can start to stack this. You can look around and then you start to see, like, you walk around the world and you're like, I see those people are living in T1, right? They like what Steve Jobs described, like they like the box. They like to be in the box and they feel very comfortable. There's nothing wrong with that. But there's people like to break out of the box, right? That's the T2. It's like, hey, they don't want to be in a box. They want to build their own box. Good. And then, you know, tier three is like, well, it's like a triangle. You're combining these things together. You know, and you're living in either world or you're living in both worlds. And if you're a co-creator living in the entrepreneurial world, you're going to be a better leader. You're going to be creating better. You're going to be working better together with your team. If you're a co-creator in an employee role, you're going to be looking for opportunities that weren't there way outside of your job description that could benefit the company. One of my favorite leaders at Disney is a VP. And he's like, you're an anomaly, Chris. You don't belong here. I'm like, really? Thanks. He's like, no. The problem is like, there's a graph, right? Most people like to reside in that, like what's normative, what's, you know, not deviate. You're way over here. So you have to decide like, but he said, you know, first of all, about 60% of your role is already defined, but, or maybe let's say 40 to 60, but there's about 40 to 60 that's not, that you can create a bunch of stuff. So what are you gonna do with that? You know, the answer to that question has defined my entire career. And what I've done. And I think we can do that.
Well, you without seeing it, because the camera would have been on you proverbially, as you were saying this, I had an aha moment. Because when I was reading through the different tiers in the book, and I'm thinking, oh, I've been in both tiers. I spent most of my career in tier one. Now I'm in tier two. And I didn't really understand tier three. Even as I was reading, I was like, I get it, but I don't get it. And my next question to you was going to be, yeah, but what does that actually look like? Explain it to me. And as you were talking, I'm like, idiot, you're tier three, because I still work for other projects and other companies. Like, for example, I've spent the last 5 seasons working on Cobra Kai for Netflix. Mm. But in between working on that show with those teams, I'm creating my own venture. And I'm constantly taking the ideas that I learned from my podcast and learned from my guests and learned from my students. And I bring it to the teams that I work with. Mm. And that's when I realize, oh, I'm already in the epicenter of the triangle, but I didn't have the awareness. Like, what? One of my favorite jokes of all time, which I think explains so much about how we experience the world. It's really simple. And it's actually very Pixar-esque. I could see this being a Pixar short. Two fish are swimming through the water. One says, hey, how's the water today? And the other one says, what's water? Right. And I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, because if I am, you can let me know. But I feel like I just realized I'm in the triangle. I thought I was outside the box and everybody else is inside the box and I escaped the box. Am I right in that I'm in the middle of the triangle?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the funny, that's the irony too, is that we don't, usually don't realize that we're right in that. And, you know, there, and then there's times too, where like there's people earlier in their career who may want that really bad, but usually it's a gradual process, right? Where it's not like you force it. It's the go back to the organic thing, right? It's like, you'll start to have these experiences that are like building blocks that will just kind of, the Legos will start to form, and then you'll find yourself in a moment like that. And you'll say, yeah, I guess I am doing this, what I've always wanted to do, you know? Wow. Yeah. So I think that's true. You know, that's, and you can design for it, but, and you can be intentional about it too. I think that's the thing too, is giving ourselves language around these things helps to power it, because then a leader can say, well, yeah, I want to do that. You know, I want to, synthesize. I mean, that's something in the music industry too, right? It's like, okay, or entertainment, you know, bringing things together that seemingly didn't fit, you know, but that do, right? Because like, that's the other thing, entrepreneurs, employees, it doesn't have to be a battle. You know, you can exist, it can exist in the same person. You can exist in, you know, all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's a good opportunity for me to wrap it up, because I made a promise that I'd have you out of here by 12:59 or one at the latest, and I want to do my best to not break that promise. So the short version of this is, you've already answered this question for the last 87 minutes. But to wrap it up, I want to bring it back to who I am is my creativity, my ability to express myself. And the world is designed to take away as much of that as possible, whether it's the school system, whether it's my job, whether it's my company, whether it's the Hollywood entertainment industry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What's the best advice you can give me to reconnect to my creativity and build a work-life blend that I love?
They start with going deep and just understand. I don't want to spoil the book, but at the very end, there's a story that just is about grounding. Right. And you put your hand on a tree, you experience nature, you connect with the core of who you are, principles, truth. Right. And for some people, that's religious, right? Spiritual, child of God. But you're true to like this center that is brave. And then you just start to expand out from that. And you find a way, as we talked about, you know, connect with those people that feel that. And then you can be brave, you know, together in ways that can really make a difference in the world.
I love it. So you heard it here, folks. We're going to fix the Hollywood entertainment industry by touching a tree.
You got it.
Sounds like a really quick life hack to me. So well done. We brought it back to a very simple life hack. I believe they now call that forest bathing. It's a whole, totally other conversation. There's literally a life hack that's called forest bathing, which means walking outside in nature. Don't get me started. Wow.
Okay. Yeah.
It's a thing. Look it up. It's just the most asinine, absurd thing.
So it's not quite like ice bathing in like pine needles or something.
No, there's okay. This new concept in the world of life hacking and biohacking. It's called forest bathing.
Wow.
And the way you do it is you walk outside in nature. Okay. That's it. So anyway, but that's a whole other tangent. So having said all of the above, this is tremendously beneficial for me. I learned a ton. I hope that everybody else listening learned a ton. We've barely scratched the surface. Where can I send people to make sure that they can learn more about you, learn more about your work, and most importantly, find and consume your book?
Absolutely. The book's on Amazon. So Brave Together, Chris Deaver, Ian Clausen, my co-author, and bravecore.co is a website, is our website. So bravecore, CORE.co. And I would love to connect with you. Yeah, I've been well-fed too in our conversation, Zach. I feel like, and I'm curious too about the Cobra Kai connection. I'm a huge Karate Kid, fan.
Oh, so. You and I are going to have to talk more. This is the beginning of a conversation, not the end of one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I appreciate it. It's been awesome.
Yeah, this has been a tremendous pleasure. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for investing both your time and energy listening to today's show.
If you were inspired by this conversation, don't forget to subscribe in your podcast app of choice, and most importantly, leave a review, because that helps move the show to the top of iTunes and get our message out there to those who need it the most. Simply visit optimizeyourself.me/subscribe to never miss another episode. Lastly, stay safe, healthy, sane, and most importantly, be well. One last thing before I lose you. If you haven't already, I want to make sure that you have subscribed to my free weekly Case of the Mondays newsletter, because it is where I share my best advice, strategies, and mindsets to help you design a creative career that you absolutely love showing up for every Monday morning. When you sign up, I'm even going to send you a bonus 5-day email course to help you clarify and prioritize the next small steps in your unique path to success. To sign up, just visit optimizeyourself.me/newsletter, and I will see you in your inbox.